This Jocks 94.5 podcast is brought to you by Millennium Satellite and Video. Log on to msbnow.com. TV excellence everywhere. That's Millennium.
Three Man Front.
Coming up this weekend, of course, guys, we're talking A-Day. We've got A-Day at Auburn, got A-Day at Alabama. Auburn releasing some details of what it's going to look like inside of Jordan-Hare. Cole, you were there for a couple of games on the sideline, but Jordan-Hare, 40% capacity, and this is going to be Brian Harsin's first taste of game day atmosphere, with the exception of when he was the Arkansas State Red Wolves coach, of what it's going to be like this fall, and he's excited.
Yeah, and I think he's tried to sort of mimic this a little bit by allowing some fans in the stands, and we talked about it last week that we were pretty certain that a lot of these coaches were doing this to find a way to allow recruits to be on campus. We know that that's now going to change with the dead period coming to an end here in the next month or so. And, you know, this is a chance for him to sort of get his team in front of the fans, give them a little bit of an idea what it's going to look like. You know, maybe some new guys lined up in different places. I know I would be excited to see J.J. Bakis at defensive line, what he's going to be capable of. I think that could be a really good fit for him, not just physically what his talent level is, but, I mean, this is going to be more of an attacking defense under Derek Mason. It won't be as much of a read and react defense, which if you're taking a guy who's quick, who's talented, who's fast, who can move, that's where you're going to be able to utilize his abilities the most. So I think he could be a really nice disruptor in that defensive scheme. I think, you know, you look at tight end, you look at offensive line, some of the defensive linemen that are going to move around, Colby Wooden, guys like that, where exactly they lined up, what are they going to be able to do? So, and some of the young receivers, when we've talked about it, you know, your leading receiver on the team last year had 6 catches that's returning, and nobody had more than 2 touchdown receptions that's coming back that played wide receiver. So you want to get to see those guys a little bit, kind of see who might be able to stand out, who's going to step up, and, you know, kind of what this thing might appear to be in 2021.
And I think both Alabama and Auburn fans, just like it was at the UAB spring game, you know, where the defense dominated. I mean, I think you're going to have a situation where both in Tuscaloosa and Auburn, you will see the defense, again, be ahead of the offense. Might frustrate some fans, but based on what we're hearing from both camps so far this spring, it definitely seems like the defense is having their way when they go head-to-head with the offense.
I want to go back to J.J. Pegues, a guy that played halfback, tight end, did a little bit of everything last year. Athletic guy, played the Wildcat there in high school in the state of Mississippi. But talking 6'1", 308, would you not think, Cole, that going from the offensive side of the ball to the defensive line would be the easiest transition when you're just talking about switching? I mean, it's not like a wide receiver going to cornerback. I mean, that's going to be a little bit tougher. But wouldn't you think that playing defensive line, going from where Pegues is now, that makes for an easier transition, maybe a more immediate impact for Derek Mason in the defense?
I think in an attacking front, yes, absolutely. If this was sort of a strike and shed defensive line, similar to what Alabama's doing the majority of the time, then probably not. But, you know, there's still a lot of technique and fundamental that comes with it, and he's going to have to sort of round that out. But he can be sort of a C-ball, get-ball guy for a little while and get away with it with what they're going to run and how they're going to run it. So, you know, I think he's somebody who he's going to be tough to move just because of his size, and then he'll be tough to handle because of his quickness and his power. So I'm anxious to see it. You know, there aren't a ton of guys out there that make that move and have a lot of success with it. You know, you think like just at Auburn, like Jay Ratliff was a guy that made that move. You know, Quinn Reese kind of went to defensive end, outside linebacker. Marcus Washington went from safety to sort of defensive end. But interior is still a little bit different. Like, I remember Charles Grant at Georgia. He came in as a running back and then went to defensive end. He was an oversized defensive end. So, I mean, it's happened. It can be done. But usually it's the other way around. Usually it's, you get to college, you don't have the athleticism to be a defensive lineman, so you go to offense. You know, they put you at H-back or guard or something like that. So, he's one of those different cases that has the size, has the frame, but also has the athleticism and the quickness. So, you know, he's a kid that can make a ton of money there. He's got to accept the coaching. He's got to put the technique and fundamentals together, and we'll see how he reacts to it. I've heard good things about him so far. I've heard that he's accepted the coaching, that he's very willing. He wanted to do it. It wasn't something that they said, you know, hey, it's this or you got to go. I mean, he kind of took this on his own, and He's been able to look pretty good so far, and I would anticipate that he's got an opportunity to do more.
Something that Paul Feinbaum said Cole on Monday when he joined the Jocks Roundtable. It's gotten a lot of attention, and I think it's worthy of some significant discussion when you're talking about rivalries, where the rivalries currently are, not only historically in the SEC, but in this day and time. This is what Paul had to say on Monday when he joined the Jocks Roundtable.
Alabama-Auburn is no longer really the driving rivalry, I think, in the Southeastern Conference. Because everyone understands the reality of it. Nick Saban is going to, you know, win 92.3% of the games or whatever. On my program, which, you know, is a more of a SEC-centric show, if I want to just drop some blood into the water and see sharks circling, it's about Georgia or Florida. And it's vicious.
This is very interesting to think. Now, I take Pat, and again, you've got more experience than Paul than the rest of us, but no longer the driving rivalry. So I think he does sort of escape saying that he doesn't believe it's the best rivalry.
Right.
But it also, it kind of sounds like he's saying that it's not the most important rivalry anymore, to which I can see where you may go Georgia-Florida with that, just because, you know, those two teams obviously have been in control of the East and they have given Alabama competitive games. But I mean, I don't know if either one of those two teams has been consistent. Maybe Georgia's been consistently closer than Auburn has since 2010. I mean, yeah, Georgia made the playoff. Auburn hasn't. They've both been in the SEC championship game. But I would go to where Alabama and Auburn have been ranked when they have played, whether it was 17, whether it was 13. And it kind of brings me back to where I just wonder with the Iron Bowl, are we to a point where we just don't know what's left? I mean, whether you go off the field and you want to go Harvey Updike, or you go on the field and you want to go kick six, like, what are you going to get after that? And we've had other games. I mean, we had 2017, where obviously you had both teams with an opportunity to play their way in. He'll go back to 2010, where there were a lot of people that believed if Alabama defeats Cam Newton in Tuscaloosa, that they would have bumped back up and potentially been in the mix to play for a national championship. So, I mean, I don't know how many times we've, and I guess it's a little bit different because it's kind of, you know, we always talk about when you grew up in football is most impressionable to you. Well, I thought Florida and Tennessee was always more important than Georgia-Florida was. And if you're going to talk about if you're going to talk about what people say and being electric and making noise, well, I feel like Florida LSU's been more of that recently than Georgia Florida has. And that rivalry has been more lopsided more recently than Alabama and Auburn has. I think people look at, yes, Nick Saban's been dominant, and you can't go look at the total wins that Auburn's had because nobody else has had that many amount of wins against Nick Saban in Alabama. So it actually highlights that it's a little bit better of a game. So I can see if you want to go importance, that can be, that, I mean, I think that goalpost could move a little bit almost every year. But when you, the amount of times we've had those two teams playing for a spot for the West, for the SEC championship game, and then with playoff implications on the line, and then the kind of games that we've gotten, I still don't think that I would place Georgia Florida ahead of Alabama and Auburn, even in that context.
I completely agree. And if you just take the last 10 Iron Bowls, the average ranking for Alabama in those Iron Bowls is number 2. For Auburn, it's number 10. So you've still got two top 10 programs that's battling. In the last 10 years, UGA, 3 times out of the last 10 years, they haven't even been ranked in the game against Florida. And 4 times, Florida hasn't even been ranked in the game. So, I mean, so think about that. So if you just take it back the last 10 years, yeah, over the last 3 or 4 years, it's been important to see who's going to represent the East. But in the totality, just in the short time of 10 years, the last decade, again, UGA has not been ranked 3 times when those two teams have played. Florida hasn't been ranked 4 times. So, and again, Georgia's won 6 games, Florida's won 4. So I'm like you, Cole. I completely disagree with Paul's assessment of what's going on around the conference. I still put Alabama-Auburn, not because we're here in Birmingham, Alabama, but just because you look at the numbers, statistically speaking, it's still Alabama and Auburn.
All right, we're going to play the game of one of the books that you had when you were a kid of You Pick the Journey. So you get to decide which direction that this is going to go. I'm going to lay out a scenario for you, Landrum Roberts, and you get to choose which part of it is the worst thing that we have seen. Wayne Player, son of Masters legend Gary Player. If you're not aware of this, he ain't going back to an Augusta National. Not next year. Not ever. He has been banned from Futures Masters tournaments. Now, there is a ceremony that we all know very well, which is the ceremonial tee off early in the Masters tournament. Lee Elder, first black man to play in the Masters, was celebrated for good reason this year. And while doing so, Wayne Player, who serves as his father's caddy, stood behind Elder, clearly holding a sleeve of Encore golf balls in such a way that gave the logo, we'll just say, maximum visibility, and not the way that you would normally hold a sleeve of golf balls before the person that you're caddying for was set to tee off. Now, it wasn't just the Masters that criticized this. There are a lot of folks that saw it on television and immediately went after him. Golf commentators expressed disbelief. Fans said that they were disappointed that it happened. And you take a momentous occasion like that was for Mr. Elder, and some people thought trying to take advantage of it in that way was unnecessary. Now, everybody, as you know, at Augusta National wears shirts, hats, logos, bags. Everything is placed all over, so it's not like it's something that doesn't happen inside of any golf tournament. But Wayne Player has since said that he has zero intent to upstage Elder ceremony. However, Wayne Player does own a stake in Encore. Quote, the only thought from that point was that it would be cool for fans to know what ball my dad was teeing off with, Wayne Player said. That's where it ends. If I've hurt people's feelings, then I'm truly sorry, and I hope they will forgive me. Now, Mark Player, who covers the PGA Tour, said Wayne has since correctly been banned from Augusta National in the Masters Tournament. What a shame, what an embarrassment, what a bad decision to allow him on the first tee after years of similar shenanigans. We've all heard about all these shenanigans, right? So many things that he's done. Remember the time that he did that one thing and the other time that he did that thing awesome. That we definitely remember because we talk about it so much. And then that other thing that other year that none of us have ever even heard of. Mark. Now, Augusta National was asked for clarification. Of course, surprised they even gave this response. We do not comment on matters pertaining to ticketing or credentialing, especially when it relates to something so specific. Encore CEO Keith Blakely said in a statement, the company did not ask or instruct Mr. Player to have our ball sleeve visible during the ceremony and are sorry if his actions caused any offense or was a distraction from the wonderful recognition being paid to Mr. Elder. Now, I ask you, Landrum Roberts, Mark Player holding the sleeve of balls for all to see, or Augusta National banning him for life? What is the worst thing you've seen?
You got to know. You got to be on your P's and Q's. You can't be trying to pull stuff when you're at Augusta National. You know.
Oh, but
that.
These shenanigans for years he's pulled.
Well, I mean, maybe there were some other things that happened that they don't want to discuss. But when his brother comes out, Mark Player.
Well, that was a guy that works for CBS that said that, by the way.
But that's Gary Player's other son. And he's basically saying that my brother was correctly banned, and he's been doing this for years. I mean, there's some issues there, apparently, there within the family, but I think the worst thing that I've seen is him displaying the golf balls. You got to know better than that, man.
I mean, I could have given you a third option of his brother throwing him under the bus.
Nothing like family.
I want to know who's older. It's like, so is he in the will, the living will right now, Wayne, to get all the inheritance? Or
maybe not anymore.
Is it Mark? I told you guys when I went there, and it was for Adam Scott, you had the three guys that dressed up in suits that looked like the Australian flag. and you never saw him on television. Now, they didn't kick him out. You can wear what you want, I guess, as long as it's not highly offensive, but you don't do that. Come on. Especially when you're honoring a guy like Lee Elder. They're on the opening tee. And knowingly, I had not even heard about this, Cole, until you just brought it up. This is news to me. But I thought you were going to say he was doing something, of course you're going to say on brand, but doing something with the golf balls, like placing them in a inappropriate position or something. Or doing like bunny ears, whatever.
So you're okay with the ambush marketing, basically?
I'm okay with Augusta National telling him you're not ever allowed back here. Could he come in? I mean, with Augusta National, could you disguise yourself, Pat, you think? Get through the gate?
No, they got facial recognition.
Yeah, with technology being the way it is, I doubt it.
Oh.
I went through all of the responses to Mark Player's tweet. Sabotaging his brother, cutting the knees out from his brother.
Yeah.
Drop kicking his brother via Twitter. And nowhere could I find this long list of all these other shenanigans every single year that he's been pulling for all this time. Maybe the shenanigans he's pulling is actually caddying for his dad. And being asked to do that. I don't know.
Did you see Gary Player though when he teed off? He did the little leg kick in the
shenanigan.
Little thing after he teed off? Would that be considered
total
shenanigan?
Yep. Years he's been doing that.
Remember when he
I would say Gary doesn't give a damn because I've heard stories that Gary is the only former champion that has a green jacket at his home.
Yeah,
he's in South Africa, and he's told Augusta National, if you want it, come get it. And that story's out there if you want to go find that. But he says he puts it on with his wife and eats dinner like every Sunday night when he's home. And he probably won't bring it back because it's got like mustard and mashed potato and gravy stains all over it. He's embarrassed to bring it back.
Gary, go put on your dinner jacket.
The tweet from Kyle that shows how he's, if you're wondering, well, I gotta see, if you're like me, when you first saw the story, you're like, all right, I gotta see how he was holding the golf balls, and how embarrassing it was for the family in the world of golf, these shenanigans. We have tweeted that out from, at the number three man front. You can check that there.
I wonder if
shenanigans.
I saw a list of possible rule changes in college basketball, and a lot of them had to do with the end of a game and overtime play. And one of the rules that I saw potentially that could be passed is in the last 2 minutes of a second period or any overtime period, they would allow instant replay review of potential shot clock violations when the shot is unsuccessful. They also want to eliminate the second backcourt rule, the 10-second backcourt rule. And they also want to give a team the option to decline free throws if the last 2 minutes of the last period or of any overtime period, and elect for that team to take a possession instead of throwing the ball in instead. So it's interesting that they're giving the teams these options as opposed to taking these free throws towards the end of the game. Doesn't that seem like that would just be a circle that would just continue to happen? I mean, if a team is down by 4 or 5 points in the last 20 to 30 seconds, then all of a sudden you're going to give that team an option whether
you
want to shoot free throws or not?
I mean, if you've seen the team taking possession, do you even keep fouling intentionally? I mean, you're just going to get yourself – I mean, it's just going to be easier to get in foul trouble, I would think. Or,
mm-hmm.
So, I guess it would make the end of games that were not ultra competitive go a little bit faster, which actually I would be all for. But I also just wonder how coaches would handle it. And would they handle it in a way that it would allow it to go that much faster?
And how about this? Maybe this is getting a little bit closer to the NBA. They're going to potentially adjust the traveling rule to allow a player to take 2 steps after lifting his pivot foot, which would make moves such as the spin move or the step back shot legal. So again, all these things are on the table potentially. They haven't been passed yet, but obviously these are the discussions they're currently having. One other rule that they might eliminate is the 5-second closely guarded rule. You remember when that came out a few years ago? It seemed like that they were really on top of it trying to call that. I haven't seen that called in quite some time. So they're thinking about potentially getting rid of that altogether.
I'll be honest, when I heard the 10-second rule could potentially be changed, when I first heard it, I was like, man, that's really stupid. But then you think you got a shot clock anyway, so I mean, it's not like they're going to be able to sit back there for, you know, 45 seconds and run as much clock as they want to. So it's not, I don't know if that would actually make that much difference, really. So when I first heard that, I was like, oh, that's ridiculous. And then thinking about it a little bit more, it might not be such a bad idea.
But what is the push for not only that, but eliminating the free throws? I understand in the games that aren't competitive down the stretch, if you went in the last 2 minutes or in the second half, Pat, but I mean, that's strategy for a lot of teams. How many games have we seen where, you know, you're up against it and you look at time and score and you've got to create stops. You can't do it by creating turnovers. You got to put them at the line. I mean, what are we devaluing being able to hit foul shots? Because how many games have we seen decided where a team couldn't hit foul shots? I mean, Alabama fans can tell you from this past season, some of those games and having to go to the line to close a team out. So I don't want to take away that strategy in eliminating that in a game. And there's no way you're going to institute it where you say, well, if the game's not within, you know, 15 points, yeah, it's aggravating and it takes forever. But a lot of times you'll see coaches, they'll say, hold off, don't foul. So I don't really understand the aim or the target for eliminating that.
And how many teams do you see, especially the last 2 minutes of the game, when they do have to inbound and they're facing pressure or they got man-to-man or a trap or something like that, that they might feel uncomfortable trying to throw the ball in? Or if you're getting close to being out of your timeouts where you can't get it in within 5 seconds and have to use a timeout, would you elect at that point in time to take the free throws in lieu of throwing the ball in? So, you know, given that coach the option, I guess that's the NCAA is thinking that potentially would benefit the coaches more in that aspect.
There is something that I would be in favor of just as a fan, and if the defense created a held ball situation, you award it to the defense instead of the alternating possession.
Instead of the possession, yeah.
Well, you're rewarding the defense for tying the guy up. So, I mean, how many times you see it and then and the possession stays, you know, with that team. So, yeah, you're going to reward that defensive play to do that. But I don't think they need to overthink it here. I mean, we're not talking about Major League Baseball. I was pretty entertained with the college basketball I saw this year, Cole. And I think I don't think you want to booger it up too much where you're taking, you know, well, unlimited fouls or, you know, you go double bonus at this point. I don't think the college game is broken, and I would hate to see it modeled after what we see with the NBA because I don't think the NBA is near as entertaining.
Well, sometimes, too, I just wonder, are we just looking for rules to change every year? Do we just think something has to change? And, I mean, I would assume that a lot of these have been introduced to the competition committee, and then they go before more people, and they say, yeah, there's a lot of people in favor of this. We need to take a look at it and see if it would better the game. And you know, I do think that speeding up the end of some games, a lot of games, would benefit things. But, I mean, how much are you changing viewership there? I mean, if somebody tunes out for the last 30 seconds of a game, maybe it takes 30 minutes. Are you really altering the ratings and viewership? I don't think you are. So I don't know how important that would be.
I want to go back to something that we asked Katie George and Cole. The biggest question for me, and I know what you asked Katie, is that offensive line, which has been problematic for Florida State over the last couple of years, and can they keep McKenzie Milton healthy? Because if they can, we all agree that McKenzie could do some special things, but that's the big question, at least for me, coming out of that spring game.
If you're talking about production at that position, and we've talked about it a lot here in the SEC because there's not a ton of returning starters coming back. We got some quarterback battles that we're sort of waiting to see how they figure themselves out. I mean, McKenzie Milton's got 72 career touchdown passes. Only De'Aaron King at Miami with 73 has more career active passing touchdowns in college football. So he's a young man that obviously can hurt you with his legs. That's a part of his game that I wonder if it will be close to the same. Is he going to want it to be the same? Is he going to be more of a pocket quarterback? You know, Katie said that he feels like he's can do everything that he could do before. She feels like what she saw of him, he should be capable of doing most of the things that he could do before. 27-6 record as a starter. I mean, the guy knows the position. He knows how to play the position. He's got the skill set, the mentality, the wherewithal to bring a different dynamic to that uniform that hadn't been there in a while. We haven't seen great quarterback play at Florida State in a little bit. So if he can come in, maybe some of the offensive line woes could be offset with some quick distribution. Norvell's a big screen guy. You know, the stretch play that they run that they're going to base their offense on, that you see Silverfield still running at Memphis now. I mean, that you don't have to be a group of maulers to be able to make that go and to be successful with that. So he'll have some talent around him. She mentioned the wide receiving core, but there were some breakdowns with that offensive line that I saw in that game, which I know some of those guys aren't going to be playing, not going to be starting, not necessarily the starting five, but still, I saw some effort things that just looked poor, just looked bad. You know, my O-line text thread, I sent a couple of things that I saw to those guys, and I think Jeff Schwartz responded, are they going full speed in this game? And, you know, that kind of gives you an idea of what we're talking about. So that group has got to improve and not just get a little bit better. They got to get a lot better if Florida State's going to be competitive in the ACC for an entire season.
Yeah, and you go back to last season, guys, and you realize just how far Florida State has to go and what a – I'm not going to say a total mess that Mike Norvell stepped into, but it was a mess, and it's not what we've been accustomed to seeing as far as Florida State football. Look, I mean, they were 3-6 last year, but their losses, they had, I mean, just some lopsided losses. I mean, you lose to Miami, and we know that Miami under Manny Diaz, they're getting better, projected to be maybe in that next tier, taking that next step, coming back this year. They lost by 42, 52-10 to a Miami team. You got beat last year by Louisville. Not a good Louisville team, 48-16. Now, you did have the bright spot in the win over North Carolina that nobody could really figure out. But some of those losses, Cole, they were lopsided. I mean, when you're losing 41-17 to Pitt at home, we saw what NC State was able to do to them. There's a long way to go for Florida State. So I know Mackenzie Milton's there. It's a great story. And they're probably going to be a little bit better. But I look at their schedule this year, I don't see a whole lot of drastic improvement as far as the record. Maybe the play on the field.
No, the schedule is, I mean, the two things that stick out about the schedule is one, opening with Notre Dame, and then the road schedule. At Wake, at North Carolina, at Clemson, at BC, November the 20th, and then at Florida, which first time since 58 that they didn't play Florida last year. Their last two games against Clemson, I believe that they've lost by an average of 40 points. So, I mean, there's a lot that needs to happen. I guess if you're going to look at the good news, you know, they get Jacksonville State, who I don't think will be easy for them. I think that'll be a difficult game. You know, Wake Forest, I think, may be a step behind what they were last year. We don't know what Louisville's going to look like. Syracuse hasn't been great. You know, UMass is on the schedule. So, you know, there are some wins there, potentially. But if NC State is what we've been hearing about, if Miami is what we think they're going to be, if Boston College continues trending in the direction that they look like they're going last year, then the schedule becomes even more difficult. So now you start looking at maybe 5-6 wins as actually not being a terrible season. That's not the standard of Florida State football that we became accustomed to, but this is a rebuild, and it's a big rebuild. And I think kind of similar to when Jeremy went to Tennessee, it's a much bigger rebuild than a lot of people imagine. And people, anytime you're dealing with a college football blue blood, people are just going to think that the rebuild is a lot faster and a lot easier. And that's not always the case.
And it'll be interesting to see how, obviously, he's used the transfer portal. He's used guys coming into the program that weren't recruited there in Tallahassee, how that's going to be able to pay off. All indications are they're really happy with the way the defensive line prepared and the way that they played on Saturday in regards to how they're kind of coming out of their own. Jermaine Johnson on the edge is somebody they really like. They think their defense is coming along nicely. I sense a theme here, Cole, developing across most spring practices, and I know you're going to get a chance to see Georgia up close, but most of these defenses seem to be ahead of what offensively they're trying to do in most programs.
Yeah, it's very normal. I mean, let's go back to, you know, kind of what Nick Saban talked about last year and why the defense struggled as much as they did is defense can't do a damn thing against air. Well, these defenses are actually able to practice against people now, so yeah. They're a little bit ahead of schedule compared to what they were going into the fall last season. I think a more intriguing question in the SEC might be, what if we took those two and we pushed them aside? If we said, okay, it's Iron Bowl, it's Florida, Georgia, whatever that is, push it aside, which one's next? Like, what's the next best rivalry in the SEC? Because Pat kind of went there, and I would go Egg Bowl. But then there's going to be a lot of people that are going to immediately jump up and say, well, when have those teams been competing for a championship or a title? But I go back to meaning, and that game means a lot to a lot of people. And there's a lot of people that still put a lot of emphasis on that game, regardless of the SEC West, the SEC National Championship. I mean, there's a part of that game that takes the place of some of those things, because those things have not really been on the table for some of those teams. So then again, I think the meaning becomes heightened. That's just another game that you can win that can place an explanation point on your season, can make your season that much better. And I mean, even if we included rivalries involving SEC teams, I still think that I would have the Egg Bowl next in line, because Alabama-Tennessee has faded. I'm not going to say it's not a rivalry anymore, because I know there wouldn't be a Twitter account telling us how many days there's been if it wasn't a rivalry. No one would give a damn about retweeting that. So it's still a rivalry. It's just not a rivalry that means a whole lot to a ton of people on one side, because they know they're not going to win it. And that's the unfortunate reality of it. But I would still, if you took Carolina-Clemson and you took Florida-Florida State, I'm still placing the Egg Bowl next in line behind those two games.
Yeah, and after the Egg Bowl, for me, I'm going Florida-LSU, because that, ever since Tebow was at Florida, and obviously Les Miles and the antics that he had with the fake field goals and things of that nature, and just the hurricanes, the cancellations, the back and forth between the athletic departments, and obviously we saw what happened last year at the end of the season, that game in the Swamp. So to me, after the Egg Bowl, it's quickly turned into LSU-Florida as, to me, one of the bigger rivalry games.
See, and I disagree with you, Pat, with all due respect, but I look at it, Alabama-LSU, and the meaning for not only both of those fan bases, but what it's meant as far as deciding the West. We just saw it a couple of years ago. So if it hasn't been Auburn-Alabama, it's been LSU-Alabama. And the game that I think that we look at, and it's built up every single year, we've seen the rematch, we've seen the game of the century, even in recent years, it's changed. And yeah, Alabama's had the upper hand, but I would say, I mean, go back to just last year, and you go back to what Coach O had to say after the win in Bryant Denny a couple of years ago. Alabama fans didn't care that LSU was a depleted team. Alabama fans, they weren't worried about that. What that meant to them, and going in and absolutely running up the score and scoring 100 points, and we heard it from fans that week, Cole, when they were talking about the buildup of the game. That's all they were focused on, is we want to play that game. They better not cancel this game. We want LSU. I think that says everything when you start talking about a rivalry.
Yeah, I almost view that game as just a big game, and we've been fortunate enough to have some very special games in that series, as I do it being a rivalry. You could almost turn these tables in a complete 180 about 15 years ago, and it felt like Auburn and LSU had that game for about 6 or 8 years, and then all of a sudden Alabama and LSU have had that game for the last decade. Now, some haven't been very competitive. Some have been some of the greatest football games we've ever seen, and some have had a ton of meaning. But, I mean, it's hard for me with LSU, because they don't really have a rival. They don't have a rivalry. I mean, there's a trophy for when they beat Arkansas. I mean, it's weird, but there is. I mean, the Golden Boot Trophy has been sitting there in Baton Rouge for a while. So, I mean, there's a lot of folks that will tell you Ole Miss LSU is more of a rivalry game than maybe Alabama LSU is, for different reasons. So I really struggle with LSU in general, because I don't view them as sort of having a true rivalry game in the instance that we know it, that we believe. I mean, again, keep in mind, I grew up in the Carolina-Clemson rivalry. Like, my parents both attended South Carolina. My aunt played basketball at Clemson. So, I mean, I saw what that game was growing up. I obviously know about the Iron Bowl and what it is growing up. I've worked the Egg Bowl. I've worked Florida State. I don't really view a lot of these games that LSU has as being on the same page as those games. I just don't. I mean, I'm not putting them in the conversation with Army-Navy. And I understand everything that Pat said about Ohio State-Michigan. It's real. I just don't put Alabama-LSU there. It doesn't feel like a rivalry game to me. It just feels like a game that's going to be on the schedule, and both those teams happen to be really good. I mean, hell, I would probably still put Texas A&M-Texas ahead of Alabama-LSU. They don't even play it anymore. just because I feel like one day we're hopefully going to get it again, and that's going to be the game that has a little bit more meaning for different reasons. So it's hard to really say LSU belongs in some of these categories that we're discussing because I don't even feel like they have a true rival. I mean, I brought up LSU-Florida earlier. Like, that game has had more venom and more vitriol and more hate and more things happening around it the last 3 to 5 years than maybe any of these other games we're talking about. I mean, Ole Miss-Mississippi State's been an ugly game on the field the last few years, not this past year, but the two or three before. But it's just hard for me to say that LSU belongs in the same category with some of those other games that we've mentioned. Landrum, I want to ask you a question about the Atlanta Braves, and this is not in jest. This is not poking fun. I want to ask you a serious question about the Braves. Because there's been one thing about this team for probably two and a half years that I can't put my finger on. I literally do not understand it. I don't know if it would make much difference. Last night, you still put up 8 runs, so you're in pretty decent shape. And maybe I'm just missing the boat here. Maybe our resident baseball expert, Pat Smith, can tell me that I'm an idiot and I shouldn't be thinking this. But are you okay with this lineup and the way that it's written out every night? Because I feel like, personally, batting Ronald Acuna Jr. leadoff is a waste. I mean, those are opportunities that you're taking away from him to drive in runs in his first at bat, no matter what. And I mean, for me, I understand you. At least they've moved Freeman up to the second spot, which gives him some protection. There have been times when that didn't even take place, and it's been more mind-boggling. Right. But I mean, you got Ozzie Albies in fifth. His on-base percentage is over .320 the last few years. He didn't have a ton of stolen bases, but he feels to me like more of a contact guy that maybe you would throw up at the top of the lineup. And with all the free agents that you've been able to go get, you go get these big boppers every year. Go get somebody who can slap the ball in play and steal a couple bases and put them at leadoff. How many more? I mean, that's going to give Acuna what? Another? I mean, how many at-bats a year would that have given him an extra base runner or two? I mean, 50, 60 more bats with a runner on base? Then he's got a chance to drive him in. I understand that he leads the team in batting average, and he's actually the most impressive stat about Ronald Acuna Jr. this year is he only has 7 strikeouts. I mean, he's cut down on the strikeouts dramatically. 123 in 2018, 188 in 2019, 60 last year and a half of a season, whatever. But you know, that would have been the reason that definitely I wouldn't have had him there to begin with. But I don't know. I mean, am I off base here, Pat? Is this? I mean, give me another example of this. Give me another example when your most deadly weapon in your lineup that had every tool to hit third, fourth, fifth was batting first.
Yeah, I can't really recall one. I mean, this is kind of an interesting situation. I mean, you're not batting Mike Trout leadoff. You're not batting Albert Pujols in his heyday at leadoff. Typically,
he's got good speed. So, I mean, it's like if he does get on, and hey, I'll give him credit. I mean, the guy's learned how to hustle. I mean, he has learned how to hit that switch, and it's pretty much stayed on.
I mean, you obviously want to get him up in the first inning. So, but I'm like you, would make more sense to me that you'd put Albies as leadoff, and then Acuna, and then Freeman, and then Ozuna, and so on and so on. Just because that gives him another RBI opportunity, because how many of those bottom of the order opportunities is he going to get with the seventh, eighth, or the pitcher being on base for him to drive in runs?
Well, this came up back in 2019, and I think it's more of just and I know you got to do what's best for the club, but Ronald Acuna, he's more comfortable there, and he wants to bat in the leadoff spot. And if that means, you know, him being productive, I realize that he could be productive in another way. I don't know. I think it's just, Cole, honestly, it's a comfort thing for Ronald Acuna. He actually prefers that leadoff spot. I don't know if it's
you're
it's
telling
a
me
thing,
that this
what
is,
it is
like. I mean, we're going back to park league ball where the best kid on the team wants to bat in leadoff, so you kind of have to let him.
Well, I mean, if it's going to be,
I'd go a step past what Pat just said, and I'd find somebody else to throw hidden second. And at least give him two more. I'd let him hit third if it were me. Because there was a wild path that I remember, because I actually went and watched McGuire play a couple of times in St. Louis. I just wanted to watch his at-bats. And he hit third some, but there was a time that La Russa would bat him fourth. And I just remember thinking, what? Number one, you're putting him in the leadoff spot a lot. And number two, you're not always guaranteeing you get him up in the inning, which I know I would want to do. Man, We talk about this in football a lot. Sometimes we overthink things in sports, and maybe analytics is a part of why he's there. Maybe it's what Landrum said, and he just has either gone to, you know, management or whoever and said, I'm batting leadoff or else. I don't know. But I feel like you're wasting a ton of opportunities. If it were his bat we got, I want to get you as many people on base as humanly possible. And if we bat you second or third, and then give them the analytics and say, this is how many base runners we have, first two at-bats in every game in the last eight seasons, four seasons, two seasons, whatever it was. You know, this will be another 62 at-bats that you're going to have a runner on. You know, if you do what you did last year, that's going to turn into another 22 RBI for you. It's maybe they're afraid he's going to get walked more. He'll get sort of the Barry Bonds treatment. I mean, but if Freeman's batting behind him, with the way Freeman's batting this year, what? Okay, good. I would say great. Now you get more runs and more total bases.
Three-man front. Weekdays 10 till 2 on Jocks 94.5, JocksFM.com, and the Jocks mobile app.